Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. It is Sarah, and I am missing my co-host, Lori, today, who would have loved to have been here for this conversation. I'm particularly excited for this one. As you all know, I've got a deep investment in substance use recovery work. And today we have Dr. Evelyn Higgins with us, who is the CEO for Wired for Addiction, which is now becoming Wired BioHealth. She is a practitioner, has been working in the field for 35 years, a lot of work in addiction and kind of compulsive disorders. And now she is in this company, supporting individuals through kind of like biogenetic testing to identify the individual biology of each person, their biomarkers, and how that results in their health and mental health, and helps folks develop treatment plans according to that. So, Evelyn, I'm so excited that you're here.
Oh, Sarah, thank you so much for having me. And thank you, most importantly, for the work that you do with the community.
Yeah, thank you. We love our people. It's been a beautiful, interesting, fun ride. And we feel like we have a really strong community of folks. And I know they're going to be particularly interested in this because so many of our people, you know, we hear like, I've tried all the meds possible. I've taken DBT. I continue to work my skills. I'm trying TMS. I'm trying ketamine. And so many people come up against the feeling of, I just don't know what to do. And it seems like your work could be a missing piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. Because what we're doing, Sarah, is looking at someone's individual biology or their individual physiology. And, you know, what we're doing in the mental health space hasn't brought technology up to where it should be. It really hasn't. There's an inequity that lies within mental health, you know, and people want to say there's no stigma attached. It's not that. Yes, there is. And we still live in this as if it's 1950, right? So that's the first part of really what got us to what we do in our company. As you explained, is now Wired BioHealth. We started as Wired for Addiction, and we've now grown into Wired BioHealth. But where we started was working a lot with people in criminal justice, from where their mental health and their addiction or their substance use disorders got them. And we use this in court, you know, showing someone's individual physiology with precision, with objective data. Instead of, let's say the judge is like, well, my dad was mentally ill or my dad was an addict, so I have a personal bias here. It removes all of that. And actually, judges love it.
Yes, I bet. Yeah. Objective.
Objective. It makes their job easier because they now say I can make a decision based on science instead of personal.
Yeah.
Right. So
that's huge.
So that's where we started. And then a lot of people started reaching out, you know, well, what about these other things that get us to the addiction part of life? Right. Nobody wakes up like, hey, can't wait to ruin my day today and my life after that. That's not how this works. Trying to diagnose. How do you get there? Self-medicating, right? And initially, whatever you find that you're self-medicating with, it works initially and it feels really good. And that's why people continue doing it. And then it becomes our next problem, right? So what are we looking at? A diagnosed condition not being treated correctly, an undiagnosed condition, a trauma, one, two, all three of those. That's how we arrive there. But what we do is just kind of admire the problem. And we put the label on somebody and we say, here you are, here's who you are, go play out your life, instead of diving into their physiology. What got us there in the first place?
Yes. Wow. Okay. I was excited for this. Like, I was showering before and thinking like, okay, how does all this piece together? Right. But I don't think I was prepared for how person-centered this is.
Totally. You know,
I have to admit, so many of our listeners have had, you know, a profound amount of trauma within the medical system, as you know, like you mentioned, 1950s, right? And I've worked in inpatient psychiatric facilities, and I was in one at one point in my, you know, late teens. And often we go to facilities in order to support our acute health and safety needs, but walk away with more trauma. And so when folks listen to our podcast, when we have, you know, clinicians on and doctors on, I often wonder if they think, you know, this is bullshit. And I am, what I'm hearing from you is like a deep investment in moving the system towards person-centeredness. And that is very hope-giving for me.
Absolutely. You know, and that's how we wound up doing the work that we do, because we said we're not using technology in this area. We need to incorporate what we've learned and technology that we can use to advance the mental health space. You know, and it's just the, you're this, here's your label, take this. Well, if it doesn't work, let's double it, let's half it, come back in 30 days and we'll switch it. This is insane. This is insanity at its best. When we have the knowledge to move past that and don't employ it, that's shame on us. That's shame on us. So that's exactly what we do, Sarah. We look at 85 different biomarkers related to mental health and addiction. So it starts out with the neuroscience piece of it, looking at the individual neurotransmitters of that person, the brain chemicals. Where are you at? Where are you at? Right? And then the hormones, from sex hormones to stress hormones, and how those interact. And then we look at what are called, this is the only heavy duty science word that I'll say, like SNPs, genetic, single, nucleotide, polymorphisms. All that means is that there is an error in the genetic coding of that. That creates things like anxiety, depression, addiction, risk-taking, impulse control. All of these are part of it. So if we can identify these things, that's what we should be doing. Exactly that. And no two people are the same. You know, we relish the fact that we're all individuals and we should all play out our lives as we are. But when it comes to this, we're like, no, you're this. Here, take this, take this, take this. And diagnosing based on vocabulary. So Sarah, if you and I don't have the exact same definition of a word, are we going to leave the doctor's office with the same script? I don't know. Did I really portray myself? Or what's the doctor's definition of that? You know, if it's like, I just don't feel like getting up off the couch. You know, I don't want to go to my kid's soccer game. I don't want to go to school. Is that depression? I don't know. Depression could be serotonin, dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, all those, 1, 2, 3, 4 of those. We have to measure to know what our starting point is. Then what we do is look at those biochemical pathways of each one of those and say, where are we having a problem? Where are we not getting to that end result that we're looking for with this particular example neurotransmitter? To what level do we have to support? Even go beyond that. One of the SNPs that we look at is called for something called the SERT gene. If someone has the SERT gene, it's likely that an SSRI is not going to be as effective for them.
Yes, this is the data our folks need.
Yeah. So let's talk about somebody who's, and we see this every day, somebody who comes to us, we work virtually, right? So somebody who comes to us and they're like, I've been on an SSRI for 25. First off, they were never meant to be that long, 20, 25 years. We didn't have the data to know what happens if we're giving that to somebody for 20, 25, 30 years plus. But we do. And their serotonin is in the tank. I'm like, first off, that drug was never going to work for you. That was never going to work and change the outcome. So what happens when somebody's been on and we change it and we switch it and we double it and none of them work? You start to believe it's all you. I just don't want to be better, right? And some physicians will actually have that conversation with their patient, even worse.
Often.
Right? Yeah.
So and then fire their patients, right? I mean, we hear that a lot.
Bingo. Yeah. So what does that do to someone as an individual? That rips you apart. There's no hope left, right? So why bother? And that's what we're doing to people.
This, I am just so excited. I can already think of individuals that I know that would benefit largely from this. And I do want to talk about access and those kinds of things in a moment. But Can I just tell you, I feel like this is, you know, this podcast was always born of a personal, selfish nature, right? I have borderline, I have ADHD, I have a laundry list of diagnoses. I've been on, you know, you name it, I've been on it. And I'm, I don't know, 350 days sober or something. We're coming up on 1 year. And I have, thank you. I have, I think this is my fourth attempt at sobriety, but it's the one that's sticking and the one I'm most invested in. But so I just want to give you an overview of why this matters so much to me. I'm the child of people who struggle with substance use. My mom's sibling set was seven, and she was the second youngest of seven, five boys, two girls. Three of her siblings have died by suicide. Almost all of the boys, I don't know if any of the boys graduated from high school, maybe one did. Profound substance use, opiates, intravenous drug use, Hep C, you know, all of those things, lots of incarceration. All of the boys except for one uniquely had type 1 diabetes in childhood as well. My grandmother was raised in an extremely abusive polygamist household growing up. She has a, you know, fourth grade education. So when we talk about trauma, just on my mom's side, profound addiction, profound undiagnosed, untreated mental health issues. Really, my mom's sibling set had a really traumatic childhood. My mom was in foster care at one point. My parents did an amazing job. I don't know how the hell they even got to where they are. They're very successful. And those, we can't outrun those generational traumas, right? And my parents do struggle. And I had my first blackout on a playground when I was 15. Mm. And, you know, have spent 15 years drinking and drugging off and on. And so from that perspective, it's like, this data would be so interesting to capture for me. But I think about, you know, my mom's family and the sibling set, and would the boys that died by suicide, you know, three out of five, would they be alive if they had had this information, access to these resources, a treatment team to wrap around them? That was missing. And it's something we have now.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you talk about that intergenerational trauma, and it's real. You know, trauma is more than just a word to describe a symptom. It changes someone's unique physiology, right? So this is all now proven with science. This isn't just conversation. Someone's like, yeah, that's a bunch of BS. You know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Let's get going. Stop being such a weenie, you know, whatever, name calling, la, la, la. It's science. And unless we intervene, we just say, have at it, next generation, keep going. Why would we do that? It doesn't make any sense.
I always struggle with, you know, like, this is my podcast and it's my story, the way that all of these things affects me. And like, how do I, you know, share pieces of other people's stories without, it's delicate, but I will say my generation, meaning like my mom's sibling set's children, struggle a lot with a lot of, you know, various mental health conditions and a lot of suicidal ideation and some attempts. And, you know, I don't know how many cousins I have, I don't know, 20 or something like that, but some of the children really struggle to function. And I would say I'm probably the cousin of the, you know, sibling set or whatever that has done the most work on my mental health. I'm also probably the one that has to do the most, right? So let's, like, I don't say that to say that I'm doing more work. I don't think that's true. But I don't see, I do see it's easier. But I don't see it's very easy, right? That shift in generations. I know that my myself, my brother, my cousins, we live with the heaviness of the generational trauma. And, you know, we all had to live through this, you know, in sibling set fighting and the in sibling set chaos and the so-and-so's using, we have to figure out how to get them housing and then the suicides and those kinds of things. And like, I don't often know where my mom's trauma ends and mine begins, right? It feels so enmeshed because I've watched it all. And now it's really interesting as an adult, because sometimes it feels like I don't know where their addiction ended and mine began, right? Because my first time drinking, I blacked out. And I remember before I was even 18, the feeling of, I don't understand why other people aren't blacking out. I don't understand why other people aren't getting as drunk as me. I don't understand how they have a turnoff switch that I don't have. You know, drinking could not be a choice for me, right? Because there is no choice. There's just, it free flows if I'm using it.
Right, right.
I am really interested to know about the genetics of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we look at those things, right? And then when, as I said, you know, we get someone's information back and it's 85 biomarkers, then we do what we call a biomarker evaluation report, 31 page report, going over each one of those biomarkers and where are you personally, we've got less than optimal results. So then, okay, what are we going to do about that? We need to do more than admire it and label it, right? Because that's like society's great at doing the labels, right? So we've identified objectively, which is what's different. And then now we're actually saying, why aren't these pathways working correctly to get us to the end result? And we identify these things, and there's clinical correlations to each one of these. So the story that you just told, it would be like, yeah, we have a predisposition for, you know, addiction. We have a predisposition for not getting out of anxiety and depression, staying in it, where someone else is like, Sarah, let it go. That happened this morning. You're like, this morning, I'm still going to be on it for, you know, a month, 6 months, a year, 10 years. I'm still going to be able to recall that one and get on it. But we identify all these. And you know what happens a lot of times when we go over this with someone? There's tears of joy. Because for the first time, they're like, oh my God, all of this has been inside of me and you've put words to it and you've made it understandable as to how I got there. There is for the first time this exhale of, oh my gosh, I'm not. And then all those things that you believe you are inside, I'm like, no, this is less than optimal here. Let's get to work. You know, and then also really good is the families now understand, right? Going over someone's report and the family is sitting there like, wow, that's exactly how they behave all day. I'm like, right, this is factual. This is objective. This isn't somebody saying, well, I think we've eliminated that part of it. They now can get on board and understanding their loved one and helping instead of hurting.
Yes, because we know what we need to do, right? I mean, I'm a therapist. I have a master's degree in social work. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I can tell you almost all of the DBT skills, how to implement them, what you need to do first, right? And I do a pretty good job at this point of implementing them. I have trained myself. I'm also medicated to high hell, right? And still, I just recently had an experience that was like very strange. It was very abnormal for me, profound feelings of rejection, unlike anything I had experienced in many years. And I was rocking in bed, sobbing hysterically, very close to self-harm. And I know what it is. I need to use a stop skill. I need to put my phone down. I need to get in a cold shower. I know what the things are and my body can't do it. And it's not often that I'm at that place anymore, but I can tell you that in that moment, I physically could not do it. And I just had to stay in that position almost until I dissociated. And I'm lucky I have a partner that's really supportive and can help keep me safe and, like, you know, do the kind of like body things that I need to do, pressure on the chest and whatever. But so often that I can't do it is framed to us as a choice. And what I'm hearing you say is there may be reasons why you can't do the thing.
Correct. Correct. Those clinical correlations are a given, right? So in just what you described, all those things happening, that would be the clinical correlation to what's going on. And there's physiological reason that that's what's going on. So, you know, you address that physiology, you know, all the tools, as you said, you teach them to other people. That's what you do. You know it, but to get from the physiology that doesn't want to use or hear those tools, not on purpose, because life is harder staying there, right? To get that ability to then use the tools is where we have this marriage.
And so say people, you know, have this done, they receive the 31-page report, they have this profound feeling of validation, I have to imagine. They can teach their families about these biomarker differences. What is the next step if somebody receives their report and they realize they have these like abnormal kind of results? Then what do y'all do to try to help support more recovery?
Great question. So moving beyond, okay, here's our report, here's all the information. Now we create a protocol based on that. So an individual protocol for you based on your precision weaknesses that we have. And either we can do that, creating the protocol, give that to you. You say, okay, we do it in four stages of how we treat those things through four stages, how we address. So either here's what you need to do. Here's what your next 6 months looks like. Here's what we're doing first month, second month, third month, that kind of thing. Or we can then work with someone over a 6 month period of time, actually following you through it. Someone's working with a practitioner, keep on doing that. We don't want you to stop doing that, right? If you are in a treatment center, we work with treatment centers. You're going to stay doing that treatment. We go to prisons. People are incarcerated. That's where you're going to be, but you're going to be doing this. So when you get out, you're not going to make the same thing that gets you back there again. Whatever the case is, we keep on, don't stop what you're doing, peer recovery, that kind of thing. Stick with it. This is an addition to where we're addressing the physiology. You had mentioned rehab several times. Can't tell you the amount of people that come to us that have been in rehab several times. Their physiology, their unique physiology was never addressed. And we know addiction is a biopsychosocial disease. That's what makes it so complex, right? So the psychosocial part is worked on. You know the tools intellectually, academically, you know the tools, but if your physiology is never addressed beyond, you need to have 8 hours of sleep, you need to eat good, nutritious food, you need to exercise, you need to stay hydrated. That's kind of the, of course, right? Your unique physiology is never addressed. We are going to be white knuckling our life, and it's not supposed to be that way. Life is a gift, right? But let's use everything to get us to that place.
I can just imagine, you know, and again, we'll talk about access, but my dream would be everybody has access to something like this, because what will that do? That will reduce self-harm, that will reduce suicidality, that will reduce domestic violence, that will reduce all of these huge risk factors that many people experience, not just people in the borderline community, right? And positive outcomes of that, better parenting, which means real generational, you know, trauma healing, better relationships, better work environments. I mean, the quality of life could be tenfold increased. So what are the, can you give me like an example of one of the things or a couple of the things that would be in that, you know, 6 month treatment plan? Like, how do you address the specific biomarkers? Is there, you know, what is the science of addressing them? Can they be changed? Or is it, you know, what are the non-basic steps, right? The, not just to get the sleep and the eat better, but what are the things that can do that?
So one of the most exciting parts of science today, and to me, the most exciting part of science, is the study of epigenetics, right? So epigenetics, we now know that, well, we've always known, here's your DNA, you're born with it, play your cards out, that's your life. But what we know now is that our environment changes the expression of our genes. Those genes get turned on, those genes get turned off. It's always, this is what you're born with, here's your cards. But people say, well, how come I never saw this behavior in my daughter till she was 21? 20 years, never saw this. I'm like, it's always been there. It was within the DNA, but the stressors in her life did not come into play. She went off to college for the first time. She didn't have you there telling her what to do. She had to start making her own decisions. She had a part-time job. She was having trouble with her major and studying. She had all new friends. They weren't all great for her. All but, you know, she was eating horrible, sleeping horrible. All of these things now come into play. And we see a different person because the expression of those genes change. So knowing all that, when we look at these biochemical pathways, how do we optimize that pathway? Combination of nutraceuticals, pharmaceuticals, but it's always nutraceuticals in the beginning. It's at stage four where the pharmaceuticals come into play if they do. And rarely, Sarah, do we have to get to that place because we've addressed so much of the less than optimal play out of those genes. Now we're supporting them for the first time that it becomes a different game. When you identify, we isolate, we measure, we identify. Now we have an actual blueprint of who you are and a game plan, not for Joe Blow, who's my next patient, but for you, because it's your unique physiology.
Yeah. So I have to imagine that's a lot of like adjusting environmental factors and relationship factors to support the expression of the gene not being, you know, maladaptive. Fill me in. What is nutraceuticals? I have never heard this term. Social worker. I mean, we love science in terms of like capturing data of people, but this is not our world, right? And it needs to be now that there's data about this. So I am excited about what that intersection could be, but fill me in on what that term is.
So natural non-synthetic plant agents that actually have medicinal purpose, not just like, here's this vitamin C. I got it. My local GNC, not that at all. Right. But supporting the body with the cofactors, the minerals. Like here's the thing. There's not a single, and I'm not anti-pharmaceutical, but you have to look at how we think. There's not a single cell in our body made up of a pharmaceutical, yet that's our go-to for the first time every single time. Nobody has bothered to say what makes this individual their physiology. What are we lacking in cofactors, in coenzymes? What are we lacking perhaps in minerals, right? Nobody looks at that. And that's what our body is made up of. Not to say, as I said, I'm not anti-pharmaceutical at all, but we abuse it. We jump to it right off the bat instead of trying to figure out, but that takes time, right? That takes time to work with somebody. And that's not how our system is set up to take time with people. Not at all.
It's not. And you know, this is where it's really hard because I really believe in public service. Spent, you know, 5 years working for the state of Washington's Developmental Disabilities Administration, various levels, worked my way up to headquarters and doing program management. I have always worked with our Medicaid population. As a therapist, my practice is solely based on folks receiving public health care. And you know, Medicaid would prefer that I see my clients for 6 to 8 sessions biweekly, solutions focused, terminate. That doesn't work. Like that works for a very small subset of people accessing therapy. It does not work for the vast majority of people who are, you know, under-resourced, have food insecurity, are living with a partner who's violent because they can't afford another home, right? 6 to 8 sessions isn't going to do anything. So you're right. It's slow. And we need to be able to develop plans to accommodate that time. But the vast majority of people don't have the ability to do that financially. So tell me kind of about the access for you. How do folks do this work? I know that this is from the systemic side, probably very expensive testing and those kinds of things, especially using technology for the first time. It's not going to be like normalized yet, right? So what does access look like for you guys? And by the way, I'm in full support of it being slow. That's what we need. Right. It's just not what our system is set up to do, as you know.
Well, I will share something really good and hopeful that we had a very, very large insurer, one of the largest in the country, come to us to do a pilot program because they know the efficacy of what we're talking about and they want to show it to their insurance company. And then, as we know, all other insurance companies will follow just to keep the policyholders. They don't really care about, you know, whether you get better or not. It's to keep the policyholder and keep generating money. But that's a really hopeful sign, Sarah, because
that's huge.
You know it. You're in the industry, right? That's huge that they came to us. That's going to take time to happen, right? It's got to go through all the checks and balances and all the other stuff that goes on. But as of now, we actually do complimentary 15 minutes with people to see if this is going to benefit them individually and then figure out how to make it work for them. And you know, that's kind of the get with the office kind of thing. And this is the lowdown on finances and stuff like that. But we offer that 15 minutes to say, share with us what's going on with you. And either this is a really good thing for you with what you're telling us or point you in a different direction. And that's going to our website, wiredbiohealth.com or wiredforaddiction.com, either one. Our phone number, 888-841-7099, and talk to us. This is what our people do, right? The goal is, as you said, you know, this layers and it's generational. So the domino theory of getting one person better and how that goes on, I'll share with you a great story. Actually, I presented this last year at the International Society in Abu Dhabi. One of our clients, 6-year-old girl in the foster system, adopted parents come to us. She's already been thrown out of school several times. She was born neonatal alcohol syndrome, right? Abstinence syndrome, and coded 3 times as an infant while still in the hospital. Rough start to life. So now we're seeing it play out at only 6 years old. Thank goodness parents say, whoa, we've got to stop this. And they have another adopted child and 2 bio children. So even the other kids in the family are like, mom, we got to do something here. Like, she's out of control, not just the school. We start working with her. Kid became a different kid. At the end of the school year, got the character award for school. Gives me goosebumps, right? So you talk about not just her life being changed, but the amount of people that interact with her on any given day in her short life. How many more years she has on the face of the earth to actually interact with people in a really positive way, and the domino theory of how many people are going to be affected by her and her behavior and her emotional quotient that she shows up in the world as, game changer. I mean, those are the beautiful stories.
Yeah, I mean, that's community care, right? At its finest, because again, if we look at generations, if we go back, if my grandmother had been able to have this sibling set of 7, I don't believe that if there had been profound amounts of data, resources, ability to change environments, that my uncles would have died by suicide. Now, we can't say that for certain, but we do know that if we have that data, like you said, we work at changing environments. We work at teaching people the skills that are necessary. We say you are not going to benefit from heroin and all the other things you're taking. And if they're bought into the process and they soak it in and they're supported, would they have died by suicide? Would their children have been impacted? Would my mom have been impacted? Would I have been impacted? You know, I can confidently say, Probably not.
And I can too. You know, and that you use the heroin as the example of use, you know, is it anxiety? Is it depression? Is it ADD, ADHD? Is it, what is it that's that driving force? Well, we change the physiology of that and it presents differently in that individual. That desire to use the heroin is no longer there. You're not in pain where you need to do that. That's just how you act out because of what's happening inside of you. So yeah, I would agree with you that the story would have had a different, for your grandmother, a different ending, for your mom, a different ending, for you, a different ending.
Yeah. Oh, this brings tears. This is amazing. Next level work. And if you have a large insurance company, as you said, who's really interested in this and what they probably perceive to be taking a chance on it and what you know is just kind of like the future of healthcare, right? We're talking about implementing AI into cancer research and testing and studying. So this is where the field is going and we need to adopt this. Who knows how long it will take, but this could be changing the game so significantly. And if it takes a while to have this available largely through, you know, private and publicly funded insurance, it takes a while. But if folks can, you know, implement this now, I believe in spending money on your health. I believe that that is an investment in all of the future that we do.
You know, investing in your health always gives us probably the best return out of anything because it changes the quality of our life. That changes the quality of our relationships, changes the quality of the work that we do. Everything is changed by that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just bought a house and,
congrats.
Thank you. It's a dream, actually. Talk about central nervous system calming. I bought a house at the coast, very small town, got out of the city, a couple hours away from family, which is good for me. It allows some built-in boundaries. I have a half acre. I have room to garden. I've never had a yard before. I haven't had a yard in 13 years since I lived with my parents. This is like healing work for me. I digress. The house came with a sauna, which I was going to invest in a sauna. I purchased a stock tank. We're setting up a cold plunge. Like those things are more important to me than having my hideous kitchen remodeled because I know that those are tools that will be so beneficial in my ability to regulate, which will then allow me to maybe paint my kitchen cabinets myself, right? So anyways, Evelyn, this has been such a hope-giving conversation for me. And I think that our folks will experience hope too. So many people we hear saying, I just don't know what to do. I've tried everything and I can't keep going like this. And I'm hearing that there's the potential that it doesn't have to be this hard.
Got it. You got it. And that's what I hope people get out of this. Exactly that hope, because everything can be optimized. There's nobody who you're done. This is it. You know, it's because we haven't looked at the right things with you.
Yeah.
You know, that's anything your listeners hear. I hope it's that. And I want to thank you for the work that you do because it's so important. This is how people get to hear what's going on and what's, you know, cutting edge.
Oh, thank you for coming on. And I especially want to say, you know, our prison population, as someone who's watched family members be incarcerated for really terrible things that they did when they were addicted and all of those things, you know, that there is a profoundly high rate of folks in our prison systems with borderline. It's very high. And it's a forgotten population. And it's a population we believe is hopeless. And I just want to say thank you for the work that you're doing there, because that shows me that you guys are really invested in the health of our whole community and not just one, you know, one group of people.
Absolutely. There's so much good that comes out of the work we do there. In fact, our CEO is on the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, chairman of the board of the Florida Justice Center. We do a lot of that work. It's not just one segment of the population. It's people that need help across the population.
Yeah. Evelyn, thank you so much. I would love to follow up in like a year and see where things are at. This is rapidly Yeah, this is rapidly changing work. In our show notes, there's going to be information on Wired for Addiction, Wired for Biohealth. Use those links to go capture more data. 15-minute free consultation. What is 15 minutes in the longevity of our lives? Go learn about if this is something that could be possible for you guys, our listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Hi, friends. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. Lori and I are so grateful that you're here with us on this journey, and we can't wait to dive into more topics in the future with you all about borderline, and even have some more fun and exciting guests to join us on the podcast. If you really enjoyed this episode, we would love if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. We would also love to see you interact with us on social media and on our Patreon page. The links to that are included in the show notes, so check us out there. We would be incredibly honored to get to know you all as you get to know us and our recovery stories. We love you, and we'll see you next time.